have. And at this point, I did want to turn things over to Emmy to just give us a quick recap of the ongoing Federal Facilities Online Academy before we start with our technical content. Emmy?
Thank you so much, Jean. So, just to plug our Federal Facilities Academy, you are now participating in one of the webinars. We last did a series of webinars in 2019, and we're doing them again in 2022. If you want to participate in the entire academy, you can take the 11 webinars either live or through the archived versions of the webinars, and also taking that 12th course, which is usually a classroom course done in person. I know we are going to begin offering those in-person courses later this year to be able to receive a full certificate of completion for the academy. One thing to keep in mind, this is entirely voluntary. These trainings really are intended just to help fill in those gaps or improve the knowledge of the nuances of Superfund cleanups at federal facility sites, because there's things always just a little bit different, or there's just a slightly different perspective to consider when we're looking at these types of cleanups. So thank you so much for everyone joining us today, and I look forward to hopefully seeing you at a future webinar.
All right, thank you, Emmy. So I'm just going to reiterate that part about credits and certificates, just reminding everyone that there are 11 webinars that are open to the public. Today is one of them. You may participate in those webinars live online or by replaying the recorded version. And then, as Emmy highlighted, there is a in-person 3-day classroom training, which is open to a limited audience of EPA states, tribes, and other federal agencies. And in that case, you may only participate and complete that course if you're able to be there in person. You can get individual certificates of participation for any or all of the online webinars, no matter how you participate. So please stay with me until the end. I'll explain how you can get one for a session, either live or online. And then if you do all of the online courses, whether they're online, live, replayed, or some combination, and then attend that in-person class and complete that successfully, then you can receive an Academy certificate because you will have done all of the online courses and that one in-person classroom delivery. If you have additional questions, though, on the certificate process, please let me know in the Q&A. I'll be watching that throughout the broadcast. So I think at this time, Emmy, we can go ahead and pull up the presentation materials and get started with our class.
Perfect. Let's go ahead and get started. While we're doing that, I'll be sharing my screen. I just want to let everyone know that there is no particular order that you have to take the webinars or the in-person class. They can be really be done in any order. I will clarify, though, that the in-person course really assumes that you've taken some of the introductory CERCLA trainings, like that CERCLA 101, if you will, and that you have a basic understanding of the process. And we can address more questions about that later. For now, let's go ahead and get into our course for today, which is on determining land use and on-site, off-site determinations. Again, I am Emmy Laiha. I'm in our Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office, or FIFRO for short, and we're very excited to bring you this training today. Before we get into the specific content of today's discussion, I wanted to get a better sense of where all of you are coming from when it comes to determining land use. So we'll go through some conversations in just a second, but just to open up the door, land use is pretty straightforward, right? At least in a general sense. There's different examples of types of land use. It could be recreational, agricultural, industrial, residential use. A lot of times in CERCLA cleanups, you'll hear references to residential use being planned for or industrial use being planned for. But essentially, land use is just based on how humans are using the land and how we anticipate to use the land in the future. So with that as a beginning point, let's take this initial poll. Okay, no, there's no... no fear, there's no right or wrong answer. I just want to get a sense of, from your perspective, when it comes to selecting a CERCLA remedy at a federal facility, who determines what the reasonably anticipated land use will be for that site? Jean, can you lead us through the poll?
Absolutely. So for the audience who's joining us through Zoom, there is a new pop-up window that has this very question floating on the screen. If you happen to be on a mobile device, you might actually have to use the three dots or more menu to load the poll on your screen. But you'll see an option for each one of the ones shown on the slide. So when you're selecting a circular remedy at a federal facility, who determines that reasonably anticipated land use? And simply click the circle next to the answer that you think is correct. So is it EPA, the lead cleanup agency, the state, the public, or is it all of the above? And then you'll see a submit button and you can send your answer on in. And I'm looking right now at about 73% of the audience having voted. So we've got a pretty good turnout right now. I'll give you all just a few more seconds. It's okay. If you're not sure, just take your best guess. And then I'll go ahead and close this poll down, Emmy. And let's take a look at those results. So it looks like almost two-thirds of the audience selected all of the above, but almost a third thought that the lead cleanup agency would be determining that. So what's the right answer?
Well, I would say the right answer is all of the above. No single group should be answering that question by themselves. It really requires a group effort, particularly at federal facility sites, to have a discussion about what land use should be, especially the future anticipated land use, and to make sure your cleanup revolves around that. But we'll talk much more throughout the first part of these slides on why that is. Let's go ahead and go to the next slide, which I have another question, again, just to get a better sense of where you all are coming from. Asking, can the land use determination at a federal facility site change?
All right, and this one's an easy yes, no, or never. So we're starting to see those answers coming on in. Again, if you're on a mobile device, you may need to look at that pop-up banner or hit the more menu to access the poll menu. And we're looking at almost everyone has voted in here. We're looking at a very strong preference towards one answer here, Emmy. So I'm going to go ahead here and give you just a second, and then let's go ahead and end this poll and talk about the results. So overwhelmingly, the big winner here was yes. Yes, it can change. Is that right?
That's perfect. Yes, absolutely. Land use can change. That's part of the reason why under CERCLA we do five-year reviews, because nothing stays the same forever, right? Again, we're going to talk more about this. I just wanted to get a sense of what point you all were coming into the conversation at. So let's go ahead and continue on. So when it comes to land use determinations, at least under CERCLA, they're a very important part of the entire process. Keep in mind that based on what that land use is going to be, that's going to help shape the cleanup. It's especially going to help shape what the remedial action objectives identified in your cleanup decision documents are. And it even goes further as far as risk assessment, which I'll elaborate more on in a second. Another thing to remember with land use determinations is that it is really intended to be a broad conversation with no single agency deciding and then defending what that land use should be. Community really does play an important role in being sure that you are conducting community involvement around these conversations of land use to make sure you have buy-in. I mean, the more buy-in you have, likely the less opposition you'll have to your cleanup as it moves forward. And the one thing I want to say that's so important, especially for very large, complex cleanups like the ones we have at federal facilities, is that the discussion should be documented in the administrative record. Very likely, your cleanup may take decades to complete, and the people who participated in that initial conversation may not be there decades later, right? They may retire, go on to other positions. So as turnover continues across all of our agencies, and we have to look back to see, well, how did we come to this agreement that this site was going to be used for industrial purposes? There should be documentation in the administrative record that captures all the efforts that went into having that conversation at the beginning of the cleanup process. Granted, for a lot of federal facility sites, if you're just stepping into the teams there, it might be that the conversation happened decades ago, and it would be really useful for you to go back and see what your administrative record has as far as what decisions were made on land use. sometimes we just assume, oh, the land use here is going to be residential, but we really have never looked at the documentation that decided that or codified it. All right, continuing forward with this, with EPA guidance, we're going to be looking at three pieces of guidance that EPA relies on heavily when it comes to determining land use under CERCLA. The first one is from 1995. And that looks at land use in the remedy selection process. Then we have one from 2001 that focuses more on reuse of those sites. And lastly, we have the 2010 guidance that looks at potential barriers to reuse and how to reduce them. So let's go ahead and start with that 1995 land use guidance. So some of the main points of this guidance, and I really do encourage you all to pull this up and read through it. If you downloaded that participant manual on the resources page, it has all the slides and extensive notes with hyperlinks. So it can make it very easy for you just to click on there and follow along with these additional resources. So coming back to the Land Use Directive of 1995, it really identifies the importance of having discussions with local land use planning authorities, local officials, the public, as early as possible, if possible, during the scoping phase of the remedial investigation and feasibility study, which is the RIFS. Granted, at a really large, complex sites, like I had mentioned before, that conversation may have happened, but it's also important to keep in mind that a huge site might have different types of land use for different areas of the site. So if there's a need to have this conversation, definitely move forward with engaging all stakeholders and inviting them to the table. This could be done through public meetings, maybe online meetings, now that people are more used to that type of interactions, but really giving community members the opportunity to provide information on what they would like to see at the site, what has happened at the site, and any other existing information, be it zoning laws or population growth patterns, any natural resources that are available. You just want to look at everything that's out there. Now, this isn't supposed to be a thesis, right? You're not going to spend years analyzing this and produce hundreds of pages on the topic. You do want to do it in time effectively, but at the same time, you want to have the appropriate discussions, because I'll tell you what, if you don't have them earlier in the process, it's likely going to cause delays for you later on in your remedy selection process. So that's something to keep in mind. And like I'm going to hit on this again, whatever that anticipated future land use is decided on, it really needs to be documented in your administrative record, because years later you can't say, oh, well, so-and-so told me that this is going to be used for residential purposes. I mean, that obviously isn't going to be sufficient. You need that documentation of the conversations that were had. Also in the 1995 Land Use Directive, it talks about how that informed future land use assumptions really allows you to do the appropriate baseline risk assessment and ensure that your feasibility study is going to be focused on remedies that make sense for the site, that they're practicable and cost-effective remedial alternatives. For example, if the future anticipated land use is for commercial uses, then that will change the exposure pathways that are considered for your risk assessment of any residual waste or contamination that's left on the site moving forward after cleanup. So those available land use types following completion of the cleanup are determined in the remedy selection process. So it informs the rest of the process essentially. I want to go ahead and jump to an example of how land use was anticipated for a site, and then we can try and stop for questions if there are any. So the first example I want to start off with is the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL. And if any of our participants have actually been there, you can let me know in the Q&A box. I myself have not gotten to get out there yet, but it's really a great example of how land use was considered in a decision. So as far as this location, it's primarily the surrounding area is mostly residential and light commercial activities. There isn't really heavy residential like manufacturing or any type of chemical processing happening in the area around this site. And it's, I mean, it's not a small site by any means. It's around 176 acres of land, 156, which are federally owned. So we're talking about a significant piece of land here, but it's NASA owned, and it's also where the California Institute of Technology, Caltech, performs R&D projects. So that's what the surrounding land uses. On site, we have a lot of federally owned land with this light commercial use in the surrounding areas. As far as the closest residential areas, they're about the closest buildings, be it residential or community buildings, are about 2 miles away from the site. So that's the information that was considered in trying to determine, well, what's the future anticipated land use for this site? Or I should say the reasonable anticipated land use. So given this information, it wasn't anticipated that residential use would happen on site, although it's happening a couple of miles outside of the site. Really, that federally owned land was anticipated to continue on with R&D type activities. So the baseline risk assessment evaluated a hypothetical on-facility resident, because no one's living on there right now, but they evaluated it in a baseline risk assessment, as well as a commercial worker and a construction worker. And this, again, this baseline risk assessment was focusing on a cleanup decision for soils at the site. Again, NASA has no intent to use GPL for residential purposes in the foreseeable future, but they did this human health risk assessment, which included the most conservative use of the land, this hypothetical residential use scenario, to provide a more conservative and protective information to determine what the cleanup should be for this OU that was primarily contaminated soil. So you can always choose to look at other slightly more conservative scenarios in your risk assessment if it will help determine what remedies would be practicable and cost effective for the site. If there is not a big difference between an on-site residential worker and the commercial worker as far as the type of cleanup that would be necessary, sometimes the site or the project teams at the site will decide, let's just do that little bit more of cleanup so that we have less restrictions in the future. So if one day we did want to allow residential activities to happen here, that could be possible based on the cleanup that we selected. If you want more information on this specific decision, it was a record of decision from 2002, and the link to that is in your participant manual. So I'll pause for a second there and see if we have any questions so far, Jean.
Sure. So we did have some people, I'll just sort of throw it out there, that in the case study and examples that you were showing, we have some people who are from there or have been involved there. So that was a familiar site that you were just talking through. But we did have someone who asked, how should active engagement with community stakeholders be handled? They just comment that the newspaper notices don't always seem to reach the full sort of spectrum of people who might be interested in participating. So they're just wondering, you know, what would you recommend or what more could be done to engage community?
Right. So here I'm specifically talking about engaging the community in land use determination discussions. However, we have a whole separate webinar dedicated to how to best do community involvement at federal facility sites. There's a lot of different tools and techniques to try and reach a community as its demographics change, as its needs change. You know, older demographics tend to like newspaper articles or postcards sent to their home versus younger generations might want a QR code or a website or a social media site that they can go to and learn more about the site in 60 seconds or less. So I would highly recommend you look into that community involvement course, which is also part of the academy, to learn more on community engagement.
Sure. We also had a question if ecological considerations are part of what you go through when you're thinking about land use. They're thinking like future potential land use, like conservation easements.
That, I mean, looking at the natural resources available at a site, it may be that it makes sense to look at conservation as a type of land use, or maybe it's mining as a type of land use moving forward. So I would say, yes, those considerations should be up for discussion when you're having those initial discussions on what the land use should be for a site.
Okay. We do have some questions about the classroom training opportunities and orders of things, but I think we'll maybe hold those until the end. So at this point, go ahead and carry on with the presentation.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Jean. All right. So we, again, type in your questions if you have them, and we'll pause and try to address as many as we can today. So coming back to the land use directive, in general, remedial action objectives are developed in order to identify alternatives, or excuse me, develop alternatives that would achieve the cleanup levels associated with the reasonably anticipated future land use over as much of the site as possible. Again, we might not have the same anticipated future land use across the entirety of a site, especially those as large as we typically deal with in federal facilities, but you want to apply as much of that as you can. In cases where the future land use is relatively certain, then the remedial action objective generally should reflect what that land use is. For example, if you're dealing with a landfill, you can reasonably assume that's going to be a long-term waste management area. And it's highly likely that future land use will not change in the future because it's a landfill and you're not going to anticipate that will suddenly change moving forward. Here's one quick example. Granted, this is not a Superfund site, but we have Mount Trashmore, and this is located, that's the actual name, located near downtown Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And the landfill footprint at its base is about 65 acres, so a good chunk of land, and it rises up to about 216 feet high. So instead of just blocking off this landfill with a fence and restricting access, you know, no trespassing signs and whatnot, there was a conversation on the reuse. It's a landfill. We know it's not going to go anywhere. But in this case, they were able to incorporate some recreational use of the landfill, making it safe to do so. So that way it was not just an eyesore, but rather a useful part of the local community. So it was redeveloped for these recreational purposes. And that's one example of how to plan ahead when you know what your future anticipated land use is going to be. So why is this important? It's not just about the reuse, like, oh, we feel good when we reuse a site. There's actually a lot of economic activity that comes from reuse and redevelopment, particularly at our federal facilities. FFRO tries to estimate what this economic activity is. The graph that you're seeing on screen right now is just from data that was available. So it doesn't cover the entirety of federal facility sites, but it looks at economic activity between 2016 and 2021. And as you can see, there's a number of sites that are looked at, thousands of businesses that were identified as being developed because of reuse at that site, billions of dollars in sales associated with those businesses. And then also bear as much of value right now, it reported jobs created. You can see it's in the thousands. It's not an insignificant number. And then we have this annual employment income, which shows how much money is coming into that community and is available to be reinvested in this community. So again, reuse is a good idea, and a lot of people can benefit from those efforts. I'm going to switch gears slightly now to base closure considerations. I'll start by saying that EPA used to be heavily involved with BRAC cleanups that happened, base realignment and closure sites, for about 30 years. But in 2016, funding for EPA to participate in those efforts basically ended. And since 2016, EPA has had less of a role at these sites, but cleanup is still happening. So when you're looking at base closure considerations, the land use assumptions at these sites might be different than at sites where a federal agency may be maintaining control of the facility for the long term. So for base closure scenarios, perhaps that land is anticipated to stay in DOD ownership with no plans for transfer, or there could be established plans to transfer the land considering zoning in the area, or it might very well be known that the plan is to transfer the land back to another federal agency. Depending on who the federal agency is, if it's like a forest management land agency, then there may be plans to dedicate that land to some kind of conservation. If it's a developed area, then there might be other uses anticipated for that site. I do want to give one example of a great success story for a BRAC site, and this is at Myrtle Beach. So it was over 3,000 acres, which was formerly the Myrtle Beach Air Force Base, but now it has an airport, 1,200 new homes that incorporated walking paths and sporting facilities. Not only that, it has a golf course and a college and a business park. So this very large site was really looked at, how can we reuse this and get the most out of our efforts for this cleanup? And it's an amazing transformation, actually, and a very, very good example of what can be done when considering what the future use of that site is going to be. And again, those considerations really need to be put into your mind earlier in the process and not at the very tail end. If you're choosing cleanup levels that don't support these types of activities, be it residential homes, if you didn't consider that in your cleanup, there would be no way to apply that kind of reuse unless, of course, additional cleanup actions were done to ensure it would be safe to do so in the future. But this is just one great example of how we can reuse our federal facility sites. So I've been harping on reuse for a bit. I'm going to switch gears to a different EPA memo, which was from 2001 on making use of a reuse assessment. The memo states, or excuse me, the guidance states that when another federal agency is performing a CERCLA-based remedial action or a non-time critical removal, that non-time critical removal piece is actually the new component from the 2001 guidance. It says that it should develop assumptions of reasonably anticipated future land use as part of the response process, just like what's described in that 1995 guidance that we were just talking about. And future land use assumptions can, again, support site characterization, the risk assessment, the development of those remedial alternatives. It essentially feeds the process moving forward. But yeah, the big deal here was saying that the land use or the reuse assessment for response actions should also include non-time critical removals. With the reuse assessment from this 2001 guidance, it actually has an attachment that has a list of all the questions that your project team can have in discussion with other stakeholders to help identify what is the anticipated or potential reuse for this site. It really is site specific. It has to be tailored to the complexity of the site, the extent of contamination, and any level of redevelopment activity that may already be underway. So, for reuse assessments, it really applies to these sites that have soil contamination that could potentially be removed or managed to not pose a risk for future land use in that area. When it comes to groundwater, generally that groundwater use is determined independently from land use, and there might be a need to do more soil remediation in order to protect groundwater quality. But that is a whole separate conversation that we can cover in the groundwater webinar for the Academy if you're interested. So I wanted to present another real life example of where reuse was considered. This is the Department of Energy site at the Fernald, now Preserve, and it was a former uranium processing facility in Southwest Ohio. Operations started in 1940 and all the way up to the 1990s. And I mean, it was a large amount of land. But now from that plant, it has become a publicly accessible ecological preserve. It has wetlands, prairie, forest ecosystems, providing all of this habitat for wildlife in the area. And the remedial process was unique. I shouldn't say it was unique. It was a very good example of how the site teams were able to engage community members and representatives from the federal and state agencies in a process that really looked at integrating the remedial planning for cleanup and future land use considerations. So it was a collaborative effort between the two to ensure that at the end, there would be this great reuse of the site. And again, this is more of a conservation use, but about, what is it? It was a small fraction of the site is publicly accessible. There's a visitor center that talks about the different habitat and all the benefits of having this habitat in the area. So it, again, another great example of how you can take your cleanup and looking at the future, reasonably anticipated future land use, if those two topics can be done in a parallel effort and integrated, you can really end up with great reuse at these very large federal facility sites. Or I should say any, it doesn't have to be a large site. It could be any size site. Okay, I'm gonna get through this 2010 guidance and then we'll pause for questions. So the last piece of guidance I said I was gonna discuss with you all was the reuse directive, which was issued in 2010. And I wanted to focus on the part of the guidance that talked about changes in future land use. So those future land use assumptions or designations can change at any stage in the CERCLA response process, really. I don't think it has happened often, but it can be that when you're scoping your RAFS through your, you know, completion of your FS and you're looking at your different alternatives, perhaps those land use assumptions would change based on the information that you gather during that characterization process. It could happen. But if it happens before the ROD signature, then it's important to have any of those documents or to make any revisions to key documents. For example, your remedial investigation, your baseline risk assessment. If your land use assumptions have changed, then you're going to have to make sure that that doesn't mean you have to go redo your baseline risk assessment or look back at what the remedial action objectives are. Again, this happens if it's before the ROD signature, you have time to go back and make sure all of your documents still make sense. But what if it's after the ROD signature? Say you have your ROD, it's issued, you've moved on with cleanup, but there might be a potential land use change afterwards. In that case, an evaluation should be done to see if the protectiveness of the remedy would be impacted by that change in use and if there are potential changes needed to the remedy. So for example, if a ROD was issued where the future anticipated land use was for industrial activities and a couple of years down the road, you've implemented your cleanup, and the city comes and says, oh, we would really like to develop this area for a park for the public or the community to make use of. In that case, again, you have to see, is the remedy still protective with this land use? If you look back and say, oh, well, our remedial action objectives were really centered around industrial use. Our cleanup levels are based in that as well. So that might not be protective for a community park to be installed, or maybe it would be. You would have to look at the site specifics. But if your cleanup was, say it was cleaned up to residential values, even though it was anticipated to be an industrial area because it only took maybe a little more money or a little more effort to do so, then you could look at the ROD and say, oh yeah, our cleanup actually would support that community park. And you can work with those groups, the site project team, and whatever the city planners or reuse groups, whoever it is, for them to carry on with those actions, as long as it doesn't affect the protectiveness of the remedy. So there is some flexibility after that ROD. It's never really completely over. Again, you can consider those land use changes during 5-year reviews as well. If there's not a big event or group that comes forward that makes you think about it, you consistently think about it in those 5-year reviews. Okay, so I've been talking for a while. Let's go ahead and switch to you talking for a little bit or providing your input in a little quiz. We like to call it apply your understanding. Jean, can you take us through through the scenario here?
Absolutely. So we've got a new poll that's popped up asking what the anticipated future land use will be for this site. In this example, Laboratory X is located on a military base and is currently under federal ownership. The area is part of an NPL Superfund site and is primarily used for laboratories, office space, and parking lots. The military base plans to transfer ownership of the land and its associated buildings to the city ownership in the future. So would you say that the anticipated future land use is residential, agricultural, industrial, or recreational? So you can check the ones that you think are appropriate, then hit that submit button. Now, I noticed the audience is a little bit slower in responding, and that's okay. This one takes a little bit of time to think through and consider your options, but I can promise you there is no penalty for a wrong answer. So go ahead and just click in with what you think the right choice will be, and then we'll be happy to talk through and dialogue through those options. I've been slowly trying to fill airtime while more and more of you are submitting your answers here. Again, you simply need to check the box next to the answer that you think is right and then hit that submit button. And Emmy, it's looking like about 70% of the audience has submitted an answer. Okay. So I'm going to go ahead and just warn you that I'm hitting the close button in 3, 2, 1, end. There we go. So we'll take a quick look here. And it looks like most of the audience opted for industrial, although some felt that residential or recreational could be the correct answer. What would you say, Emmy?
So this question was a little bit tricky, but I would agree that if you looked at this information and you say, okay, well, there's already labs and office space and parking lots, it makes sense that this area would be used for industrial or maybe commercial uses in the future. So I think that was a really good guess. However, if there's some uncertainty with that assumption, perhaps during the land use discussions, when you were scoping out the RIFS, there were conversations around how great this would be for redevelopment as a residential area or as a community park or whatever it might be, then perhaps it would make sense for the anticipated future land use to be residential because it would be informed by those conversations that previously happened. So if you went with residential, I could potentially see why, but my gut reaction is, oh, this looks like it should be industrial. But again, who gets to make that decision? It's not a single agency. The regulators can't come and say, well, we don't know what's going to happen here, so you have to clean up to residential levels in order to support any potential future land use at that site. That doesn't sound accurate. The lead agency or the other federal agency who's leading or implementing CERCLA at the site can't come and say, well, we're going to own this land forever. It's industrial now. It's going to be industrial then. And that's how it's going to stay. That may be how a group feels, but it's really important that all the stakeholders, including all the agencies that are involved, your lead agency, the regulators, both state and federal, and impacted community groups or other stakeholders, particularly if there's something like tribal interest related to your site, that larger conversation should be happening. Or else, say you don't, say there's an agency, I mean, you do see this with some federal agencies, we're gonna own this land forever, this is what the land use is, this is what we've decided. And perhaps that can get pushed to a certain extent, but when it comes to implementing your remedial action, say you put out those proposed plans for public comment, right? You get a slew of public comments. We do not agree with this. Your land use assumptions are entirely wrong. You can get a lot of opposition that will essentially delay your cleanup process in the long run. So again, that's why it's better to have the discussion sooner than later with all the affected parties at the table. Okay, let's go on to the next slide, which is another apply your understanding. Jean, would you take us through this scenario?
Okay, so we're gonna launch this next one and it will work in a similar fashion. So again, we're asking what you think the anticipated future land use is in this situation. And in this particular case, land along a river is part of a federal facility NPL Superfund site and is currently under federal ownership. The area is primarily used for chemical processing activities and is being cleaned up under CERCLA. The city is interested in developing the land for hiking trails. So would you say that the anticipated future land use is residential, agricultural, industrial, or recreational? We've got about a third of the audience having voted now, and I think we'll just push on a little bit, about half of you. It's okay. Again, you just click the answer little box next to the one that you think is right and hit submit, and that'll cast your vote on in. And when we get to about 70% of you having voted, I'll go ahead and close it down and we'll talk through. It does seem like there's more agreement on this particular one.
Ah, okay.
All right, and I'm going to go ahead and end the poll. And in this case, it looks like almost everybody picked recreational. That was the use, but there were some looking at residential and industrial.
Great, and I'm not surprised that we have some different answers here with this scenario. It almost comes down to, well, who would you ask? If you ask the federal agency who owns the property, they might say, oh, well, chemical processing activities happened here, so we're going to keep this as industrial. If you asked the city or what the anticipated future land use is, they would likely say, oh, for sure, it's recreational. This is, you know, riverside property, very, very attractive. We want to make sure we use it. Perhaps if you have regulators who are a bit excited about what's happening at the site, they could say, oh, this is prime real estate to be developed. It absolutely has to be residential for the anticipated future land use. So again, I would agree that recreational would be a reasonable future land use for the site, given the interest from the city. But that it just comes back to my point that having a conversation with all the affected parties, not just those who are members of the federal facility agreement, your lead agency, EPA, and usually the state, but with your larger community and stakeholders, to identify this sooner than later is really important to ensure that you're going through your cleanup process with that land use in mind. But thank you to everybody who's participated in the questions. I hope you're finding them helpful. So I'm going to pause for a second and see if we had additional questions before continuing with the reuse directive from 2010. Was there anything that popped up, Jean, that we should answer now?
So we did have someone who asked, over the long term, isn't it critical to include land use restrictions in deeds?
Yes. Institutional controls are very important to maintaining those restrictions or on land use. Like, for example, you can't dig wells here, or you can't dig below so many feet here. And it's really important that the authority for implementing those institutional controls and the responsibility for ensuring they remain at the site be identified in your record of decision in very clear language. Sometimes, even at our federal facility sites, that might be the state that needs to ensure those ICs move forward. It might be another group, not necessarily the federal agencies involved there. So definitely ICs play a very big role, and those deed restrictions, making sure they're maintained, is important, which is why we look at ICs and five-year reviews.
Okay. Somebody wanted to know how you would deal with uncertainty tied to reuse after the ROD. They commented that there may be plans with private entities taking the lead to conduct redevelopment, but they can fall through sometimes. So how do you address that?
So I know I'm going to rewind a little bit. So when you have uncertainty in land use, I would hope that uncertainty would be made known during your CERCLA process before the ROD is signed. In that case, you could look at different remedial alternatives, potentially supporting different types of land use, and that might help shed light on if those alternatives are cost effective and practicable. And sometimes doing that earlier in the process will show, man, this is just not practicable, this land use, or that was desired by the community, it's not something we can readily implement because it's impracticable or not cost effective. But if you're looking at uncertainty after the rod has been placed, I would hope the rod identified a very conservative approach to risk and likely went with a remedial action objectives and cleanup levels that were basically wouldn't preclude future use of the land. So I guess it would depend on some of the site specifics there, but I hope that that answer helped.
Sure. We did have someone who commented that many federal agencies don't have authority to encumber federal properties with deed restrictions. And I don't know if you can talk about how you might recommend implementing ICs at those types of sites.
Oh, we could have a whole conversation on institutional controls, because that's absolutely right. That's why it's so important in the ROD to identify who has the authority to implement these ICs. And in our best good faith moving forward to ensure that they stay in place. So in those five-year reviews, the lead agency can look back, see if those deed restrictions or what have you, whatever it is that has to be implemented through another governing authority are being kept in place. If they're not, then that's the opportunity to have a discussion with those parties and try to ensure that the restrictions or those deed restrictions continue to move forward. And if they are moving forward and being kept up to date, at least you're checking in every 5 years to make sure that they're still applying. So yes, that's, and it is difficult when you have to make sure something is happening that your agency doesn't directly have authority over.
Okay. I'm going to take one more question here, and then perhaps we'll have time to circle back to some other ones. If a site is suitable for UU, UE, for example, like any land use, and it's been transferred to another federal agency, can you talk a bit about emerging contaminants and how those might be handled?
So if your site was cleaned up to unlimited use, unlimited exposure, UU, UE, that essentially means there's no waste left on site that poses an unacceptable risk to the public, to human health and the environment. So essentially there should be no institutional controls, no deed restrictions. It's really anything goes. This is unlimited use, unlimited exposure. Go ahead. But if it turns out that what you think you're done with cleanup, but there's an emerging contaminant at the site, perhaps it is associated with groundwater movement. I think a lot of our emerging contaminants do look at the groundwater, you know, fate and transport pathways, but it could be some kind of VI concern as well that we weren't aware of before. In that case, if there is something posing a risk, even though the previous action or remedial response addressed the known risks and contamination, if there is an emerging contaminant that can potentially pose a risk to human health and the environment, I would say that might be the need to establish, come back to the site, characterize what the issue is, better understand it, and if necessary, move forward with an additional response action to address that emerging contaminant. The challenge there is that we don't always have very specific cleanup levels or authorities on those emerging contaminants might still be in discussion at, you know, the higher levels of government. So it does present a challenge, but ultimately you want to know if people's health is at risk, is the environment at risk? And I think as long as you're guiding your efforts through that question, it'll help lead you in the appropriate direction to do the characterization and if needed, take additional response actions at that site.
Okay. I think perhaps in the interest of time, let's go ahead and carry on with the presentation.
Okay, thank you so much. Let's jump back into some last points on this 2010 reuse directive. I touched base on this a little bit before. Productive reuse at a site can have so many benefits for a community, and it can also support the effectiveness of a remedial action. We were just talking about how deed restrictions might get lost and not be passed down or implemented moving forward. But if a site is actively being reused in a way that the community supports, it can help avoid some of those inappropriate communities. Things like illegal dumping at a site or off-road vehicle use can help ensure that the remedy remains protective. And when you have that stakeholder support for the property's reuse activities, it just you have their buy-in, you have their interest, there might be more public support and action taken to maintain the effectiveness of that remedy into the future, because they are also benefiting from it. So they have a reason to ensure that those benefits continue. And again, it can help improve quality of life. We looked at some of the economic benefits through jobs and money generated through site reuse. So it can be a win-win for all the groups involved or impacted by that cleanup. Coming back to ICs, we spent some time talking about this. You do, when looking at future land use, want to consider your institutional controls, because that federal agencies or state agencies might not be the ones with the authority to implement or maintain those ICs long-term. You want to make sure you're working with local governments, because often they can play a vital role in ICs that fall under their jurisdiction. And it's especially important that ICs be considered when federal facility land is going to be transferred outside of federal ownership. Just making sure everyone is aware what those ICs are and their need to be maintained moving forward once that transfer of ownership happens. So that is everything we have today on land use determinations. We're going to switch gears a bit to on-site and off-site determinations that are often questions that have to be addressed during cleanup. And I'm going to ask my colleague, Jeff, to go ahead and come on camera and get ready to share the slides. He will be presenting on the second half of this webinar. And again, we'll pause for questions as we go through the material. So Jeff, are you on?
I am. Can you hear me all right?
Yep. Sounds good.
All right. Well, thank you. Let me adjust this really quickly in my screen here and make sure, can everyone see my screen all right?
I see a screen.
All right. Let me get to the right slide here.
I think we're still looking at Emmy's slides. So if you want to try to share again, we'll go ahead and put yours all up right. There.
Let's try that again. All right. Let's see what we got here. Now that we're all right. How's that? Is that better?
I don't yet see yours. Emmy's went away. So let's try to share yours one more time.
All right. Let's try this once again.
But some of the attendees are a fan of your sweater. I just wanted to share
that. Oh, well, thank you.
So it does look like, there we go. So we've got slide 25 up. There we go. Beautiful.
We are good. Thank you for that compliment, by the way. And thanks for your patience as we work through technical difficulties. Well, let me first introduce myself. Hello, my name is Jeff Schramm. I'm a remedial project manager at the Hanford site in southeastern Washington. I also teach physical and biological sciences at Washington State University. So that's a little bit about me, but let's pivot and talk about on-site and off-site determinations. Before we get started with it, let's start with the group poll and ask the question, what challenges have you dealt with in regards to on-site and off-site determinations? So Jean, are we looking at the chat for that, or?
So yeah, in this case, we're gonna have everybody actually use the Q&A, and I'll be summarizing the messages as they come in the Q&A. So you all can actually type in your responses there, and I'm starting to see some messages coming into the Q&A now. And again, the question that we're asking is essentially, what challenges have you dealt with in your on-site, off-site determinations? And as I'm scrolling through here, some of the comments I'm seeing that an off-site determination was changed and they were forced to use a new disposal location. Again, I'm starting to see other people chiming in that there were modifications or changes made to those determinations. So you can open up the Q&A, and if you've encountered a challenge, go ahead and put it in the Q&A. We've got more modifications. We have one person who noted that the military insisted that the cleanup levels in the ROD also applied offsite. We had characterization challenges. They had land transfers from governments to private entities that resulted in long-term O&M. See, just concerns with protection for some of the wildlife in the area. Lots of disagreements between some of the federal entities involved. I think that would be a predominant theme that I'm seeing here.
Yeah.
So, how does that sound, Jeff?
Yeah, that sounds exactly like the process, actually. It can become very complicated and requires a lot of work between agencies. And it, as your comments convey, it can be a challenge. So let's talk a little bit about what the offsite rule is and what its purpose is. As it states on the slide here, the offsite rule applies to any CERCLA response action involving the offsite transfer of any hazardous substance, pollutant, or contaminant or CERCLA wastes. Section 121D3 of CERCLA requires that CERCLA wastes may only be placed in a facility operating in compliance with the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, or RCRA, or other applicable federal or state requirements. The section further prohibits the transfer of CERCLA waste to land disposal facility that is releasing contaminants into the environment, and requires that any releases from other waste management units be controlled. So we're talking about control of these contaminants. Ultimately, we're looking at cleaning up. And what is the purpose? So the purpose of the offsite rule is that we're ensuring that the work that we're doing and the CERCLA waste that we are dealing with do not contribute or present or future environmental problems. So we're trying to clean it up. And in the process of cleaning it up, we're not wanting to create more of a cleanup problem. And so that's the purpose of what the offsite rule is. The other thing about the offsite rule is it establishes criteria and procedures for determining whether facilities are acceptable for the receipt of CERCLA wastes from response actions authorized under or funded under CERCLA. It also establishes compliance criteria and release criteria and provides a process for determining whether facilities are acceptable based on those criteria, and provides procedures for notification of unacceptability, reconsideration of unacceptability determinations, and reevaluation of unacceptability determinations. So what actions are affected by the offsite rule, and who is affected? The offsite rule applies to any remedial or removal action involving the offsite transfer of any hazardous substance or pollutant or contaminant, again, CERCLA wastes, that is conducted by EPA, states, private parties, or other federal agencies. If the action or is fund financed or is taken pursuant to any CERCLA legal authority, it falls within that purview as well. Included are cleanups at federal facilities under Section 120 of CERCLA and cleanups under 311 of the Clean Water Act, except for certain petroleum materials that are exempt from CERCLA. Applicability extends to those actions taken jointly under CERCLA and another authority. So just remember that the offsite rule only applies to those actions being taken under CERCLA authority or using CERCLA funds. So if there's no CERCLA funds or authorities are not involved, or if waste is not CERCLA waste, then the OSR doesn't apply. Again, who is affected? Anyone who through a CERCLA authorized or CERCLA funded removal or remedial action wants to transfer CERCLA waste from cleanup site to any U.S. offsite facility. So that's who it applies to. So we have a pre-recorded video from an RPM from Region 4, Rob Pope. He's been kind enough. He wasn't able to make it today, but he's been kind enough to talk about a site that he's familiar with. So, Gene, did you want to cue that up for us and let us take a look at it?
Absolutely. Let me put it on now.
Okay. So, hello, I'm Rob Pope. I am a senior RPM in Region 4, Atlanta, Georgia, and I have done some of this, determining land use and determining on-site and off-site for different uses as we go through remedial action, and I'm happy that you guys can sit in on this webinar. Thanks. So here is an example of a very common off-site rule facility. This is called the Spring Hill Landfill. It is in Northwest Florida. It receives waste from Tyndall Air Force Base regularly. It is basically a Subtitle D RCRA permitted landfill. And so it is a solid waste landfill. So they cannot take hazardous waste, but there's a lot of the waste that comes off the base that is not hazardous waste that still is CERCLA waste. And so this facility has to be CERCLA offsite rule approved. And basically what happens is the facility, which is managed by Waste Management, is in contact with the offsite rule coordinator. Each region has one. They're normally in the RCRA division or the division that holds the RCRA group. And then that offsite rule coordinator can tell you if the facility you're looking at is offsite rule authorized. This one has also received waste from Deepwater Horizon, for instance, and so we used it under other CERCLA response actions. It's about 68 miles from Tyndall Air Force Base, so it's not insignificant to truck things 68 miles from the base, which is right on the edge of the water, to this landfill that's upper in the upper part of the county, well above flood lines and hurricane concerns. But it's a good, safe option to put that Subtitle D waste. And sometimes what Tyndall has had to do is treat and stabilize waste so that it is not hazardous waste, and then they can ship it to this landfill. And this landfill is very careful about checking to make sure that it has been treated appropriately. One thing to be aware of with these offsite rule facilities is that the determinations do expire. The offsite rule coordinator doesn't give them a carte blanche. It's yes, right now it's fine, because if they start having violations of their RCRA permit out of the state or something like that, the offsite rule coordinator should be aware of those and will probably take away that offsite rule determination until they have addressed those concerns from the state authorized permit. And it doesn't have to be a RCRA landfill. It can be some other kind of landfill, but it has to have this offsite rule acceptability. And this is probably the most common one of these Subtitle D landfills. Subtitle C landfills, of course, always have these as well.
All right. So, Gene, do I need to share my screen again? Is that how it works?
Yes, please.
All right. All right. Can we see everything okay?
We can. It looks great.
Great. So if you were able to see Rob's video associated with that recording, you'd notice that I am a stunt double for Rob Pope. I get brought in to jump out of a window or fall off a building or teach the occasional training. So I get mistaken for Rob a lot. He is a superstar within our agency. And so I'm happy to be a stand-in and fall off a building for him anytime. So thanks to him for taking the time to do that recording for us and be part of the training today. So let me switch here, since that was a slide. There we go. So this is my backyard. This is the Hanford Nuclear Site. It's located in Eastern Washington State. You can see in the upper right-hand portion of the picture there, kind of a aerial footprint of the site itself with the Columbia River at the top. And that star in the center is the effluent treatment facility that I will be speaking about. And just to give you a little bit of history about Hanford, if you're not familiar. It is about 500 square miles of land. And for 30 years, the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy produced tons of plutonium for use in the atomic weapons program. Activities on our site here at Hanford produced significant quantities of waste containing hazardous chemicals and radioactive materials. Ultimately, it provided the fuel for the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki, helping to bring the end of World War II. And so it's a significant part of the Manhattan Project, and has wastes that we are currently dealing with and will be dealing with for a very long period of time. But this picture that we're looking at here is the Effluent Treatment Facility, also known as ETF. We in the government love our acronyms, and so Hanford is no different. It receives liquid waste from the Liquid Effluent Retention Facility. And what that is if you look at the upper right, and I'll turn on my laser pointer. Right up here is the Liquid Effluent Treatment Facility. There are three basins here that are permitted by the state of Washington to collect waste. And you can kind of see that there's opportunity to construct another one. And then just below it here is the Effluent Treatment Facility. And so it is located in Hanford's 200 East area, which is geographically, as you can see, right in the middle of the Hanford site, but is considered off-site for remedial actions. These facilities handle, as I said, liquid waste from groundwater remediation and condensate. And LRF stores those liquids and then transfers them to the effluent treatment facility to be processed. So once the wastewater has been treated through ETF, it's stored until tests can confirm that various radioactive and hazardous contaminants have been removed or lowered to levels that make it acceptable for discharge to a state disposal site within the Hanford area. And this site is a state permitted facility under the Hanford site-wide RCRA permit that is managed and run by Washington State. And so that is the effluent treatment facility. The permit requirements, permits, as I said, in the case of the effluent treatment facility, it's part of the site-wide RCRA permit. Permits are required for CERCLA work conducted off-site, but not on-site. The term on-site means the aerial extent of contamination and all suitable areas in a very close proximity to the contamination necessary for implementation of the response action. So note that as it relates to on-site, the term, quote unquote, as I use my air quotes here, site is defined in a record of decision. And we'll talk about that a little bit more when we come back to the Hanford site after we look at another example. But while responsible parties and federal facilities are not required to obtain a permit for on-site, they must meet the substantive requirements of the various statutes that apply. And so you'll hear that often when you're dealing with CERCLA, that they must meet, for instance, RCRA, the substantive requirements of those statutes that apply. A little more about permits. Permits are required for work conducted, again, off-site, but not on-site. We talked about the aerial extent. Got ahead of myself there. So let's talk a little bit about dispute resolution. When you gave your comments as far as what you've dealt with on your facilities, you hit it right on the head. You know, these are not easy decisions sometimes. They require a lot of work. They require a lot of collaboration. And sometimes these decisions are disputed and have to go through a dispute process. So shown here is the Weldon Spring former Army Ordnance work site in St. Charles County, Missouri, approximately 30 miles from St. Louis. The site encompasses approximately 17,232 acres, including mixed areas of ownership, state, federally owned land parcels. The site here that you see on the left was acquired, the property was acquired in 1940 and began production of trinitrotoluene or TNT and dinitrotoluene DNT in 1941 to support the war effort in World War II. The Army constructed 18 identical TNT and DNT manufacturing plants beginning in May 1941 in the area known as the Weldon Springs Training Area, or WSTA. Following the deactivation of the production facility in 1945, the majority of the property was transferred to the state of Missouri and local entities. Historical Army operations resulted in release of hazardous substances to the soil and groundwater in this site. So you can kind of see that we've got multiple responsibilities from multiple different agencies. The site was listed on the NPL in February of 1990, and a federal facility agreement became effective on August 8th of 1991. So the WSOW, or the Weldon Springs Ordnance Work site, surrounds and is adjacent to the Weldon Springs quarry plant and pit site. This site is a separate NPL site, was listed in March of 1989, and is managed by the Department of Energy, which is the lead site for that particular. So you have the Army, the Department of Energy next door, you have the state of Missouri, some other entities, and that's kind of paints the framework of the site. So you can already get an idea of how complicated these discussions might be. So in 1994, in August of 1994, Missouri invoked the Federal Facility Agreement's dispute resolution procedures regarding the state's authority to require permits for the incinerator, contaminated wastewater treatment, and storm water runoff activities that were described in the ROD. And in September of 1994, the Dispute Resolution Committee elevated the matter up to the Senior Executive Committee. Unable to unanimously resolve the dispute, it was elevated to the regional administrator. And all this process was all defined in the Federal Facility Agreement. It's all lined out in the FFA. And so they began to follow this process and not find resolution and elevate it to the next process. And ultimately, Missouri elected to elevate the region to the region's decision for resolution. And in this case, it is undisputed that the response actions at issue will be conducted entirely within the geographical area considered on the NPL site. But Missouri's position was that because of the offsite releases and discharges will occur, that the state may seek to require the Army to obtain permits. Throughout the dispute, the Army had asserted that the permits are not required for the subject of activities. And furthermore, the Army had stated that it was unwilling to jeopardize its ability to carry out its circular responsibilities by agreeing to apply for a state permit that CERCLA does not require. So this might sound very familiar to the projects that you've dealt with in this process, you know, that where you can't seem to come to an agreement, and as hard as we may try and working those relationships and creating buy-in and talking through these problems, we do find ourselves in these dispute processes sometimes. Missouri contended that what constitutes on-site in EPA's view was overbroad, and that the response actions under the selected remedy will inevitably result in extended off-site discharges beyond the on-site area and thus require state permits. So EPA has long viewed response actions that may have discharges or releases which subsequently migrate beyond site boundaries as qualifying for CERCLA exemption, CERCLA 121E1 exemption. EPA interprets the CERCLA section and the corresponding provision in the NCP as extending or exempting response actions conducted entirely on site, even if the actions involve discharges or emissions that result in some subsequent migration of contaminants beyond the site boundaries. And furthermore, since some off-site mitigation is likely to occur in virtually all cases where there is an on-site discharge or emission, adopting the state's interpretation would greatly narrow the kinds of permits to which the exemption applies. And so this dispute went from following the guidance in the federal facility agreement, went up to the region, and ultimately went up to the EPA administrator at the time, Carol Browner, who made a decision that stated that the EPA interprets the CERCLA section and the responding provisions of the NCP as exempting response actions conducted entirely on site, even if the actions involve discharges or emissions that result in some subsequent migration of contaminants beyond site boundaries. So this is one example where oftentimes those disputes, maybe some that you've talked about when we were looking at our poll earlier, were able to be resolved earlier on in the process. But this is the one this is one of them that that reminds us that ultimately the EPA administrator makes the call on these types of decisions. Now might be a good time, I should ask, are there any questions that anyone has? Jean, am I missing any important?
Sure. We had some questions specifically about Hanford and the effluent treatment plant. One of the attendees wanted to know if you could explain how the Hanford effluent treatment plant is defined as, quote, offsite.
Yeah, how it's defined as offsite. You know, Emmy, you might be able to help me out with that. It's defined by offsite. I can tell you that it's defined by offsite because of a determination was made that it would be offsite and a permit was required. Emmy, maybe you can elaborate a little bit on that.
Sure. I can talk about this a little bit more broadly. So when a CERCLA cleanup is being implemented, any waste generated from that cleanup needs to be managed correctly, right? If it's going to maybe an on-site landfill, there's likely CERCLA decision documents that authorize that landfill and ensure that it meets all the appropriate regulations and requirements. But when it comes to facilities that are managed under RCRA, often that requires the offsite determination to ensure that the facility is in fact complying with all of its requirements and that it's safe to send these CERCLA waste to, in this case, liquid waste to that facility to be treated. So anytime you have a RCRA permit, be it for TSDs, treatment, storage, and disposal facilities, regulated under RCRA, or it could be under TSCA or other federal or state environmental law, that offsite determination is necessary. And usually a permit is involved.
I hope that answers your question as it relates to specifically, you know, the offsite determination on the Hanford site for ETF. That was a long time ago that was made. And so I hope that the general answer answers your question. Any other questions, Jean?
I think not at this time. So why don't you carry on and then we'll circle Perfect. Back later on to the outstanding ones.
So as previously mentioned, while parties and federal facilities are not required to obtain a permit, on-site determinations, they must meet requirements and permits in various statutes that apply. Again, the substantive requirements must be met for that waste. This applies to on-site work. The Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, or RCRA, is a good example of this. It must be adhered to when handling hazardous wastes when you're looking at on-site. So for example, small quantity generators can keep their waste on-site for up to 180 or 270 days if they're in a treatment, storage, and disposal facility. is more than 270 miles away. Large quantity generators of waste can only store waste for up to 90 days without obtaining a permit. So record corrective management units are used to deal with some of that, some of the on-site waste. So again, it's important to note that in these cases that they must follow the RCRA requirements for handling hazardous waste on site. So on-site work, an example, an on-site disposal cell is an example of something that would require that. So to come back to the Hanford site, for those of you who know Hanford, and those of you who might not, this is a little bit clearer picture of the Hanford site. It shows you, and I'll bring my little laser pointer out here again to give you an idea. This is the Columbia River up on the north side of the site here. These are different reactors that this is what's commonly called in our neck of the woods, the river corridor. And these are reactors that are in the process of being cleaned up, and some that have been cocooned for a period of time while their radioactive constituents decay. If I'm right around this area, this is where ETF might have been. We're now looking at the Environmental Restoration and Disposal Facility, Hanford's, we call it ERDF. Hanford's Environmental Restoration and Disposal Facility is in the 200 area. Get my laser pointer off of here. You can see the circle is in the 200 area of the Hanford site and is a massive landfill regulated by the EPA under CERCLA. It was built in 1996 and accepts low-level radioactive, hazardous, and mixed wastes that are generated during the cleanup of remediation activities on the Hanford site. It does not accept any non-Hanford waste. And one of the other things about the ERDF site too is that it's our responsibility in managing this waste site on Hanford to mitigate its footprint. So this particular landfill, ERDF, is composed of 8 original disposal cells and 2 supercells, as they're called, that are twice as large as the original cells. Each supercell is designed to hold approximately 3.6 million tons of material. The original cells were constructed in pairs, with each cell measuring approximately 500 by 500 feet long by 70 feet deep. So that gives you kind of an idea of the scope of this particular site. And the facility was designed to keep the environment safe by isolating waste and leachate, rain, dust suppression water, and contact with the waste is collected underneath it and processed in through pump and treat facilities and managed in that way. A double liner leachate collection system collects and removes leachate from this trench and is transported to a treatment facility in the west area of Hanford's 200 area. And so one of the things that's interesting, as I mentioned, you know, we have a responsibility of keeping the footprint small at ERDF, which means that it has a ROD established for this site. And that ROD is very specific as to what waste can be brought into ERDF. There's actually a ROD amendment that allows us to look at other wastes that might be similar to what is in the ROD. It's a plug-in approach that, as we're cleaning stuff up on the site, if it's similar to other wastes, we can accept it. But sometimes it's a challenge. It's a large site. There are a lot of things to get demolished and cleaned up. And every once in a while, you know, the lead agency or folks want to bring stuff into ERDF that may not be appropriate. And so an example of that is in the early part of the 2000s, as I mentioned, as I bring out my laser pointer here, this is the River Corridor. There was some, one of the things that, and as I mentioned earlier, that that ERDF waste needs to be contaminated. Again, it's about, we can't just take waste on the site from everywhere because it would fill up very quickly. And so we have to, the ROD defines a discerning window of waste that can be accepted. So in the early 2000s, there was some work done here at the D reactor and over here at F and in those areas. So in looking at that, you know, the discussions for how that waste is handled is, you know, happened with project managers and managers in a room. So some of this is rumor, but what I can tell you is that there were at the D, the 100D and 100F, there were non-contaminated reactor process water tunnels where water would come in through the reactor to cool the reactor that was non-contaminated to cool the reactor. And there were underground, and this was in this area here in D, and in F, there were underground filtered water storage basins that were scheduled for demolition. And so there was some discussion, supposedly as rumor has it, is what we were gonna do with that waste. But ultimately it was decided that for a myriad of reasons, not being contaminated and other things, that was not appropriate for the ERDF facility. And kind of the caveat to that was that these process tunnels, water process tunnels and storage basins were home to the largest maternal bat community in Washington state. There were about 3,600 bats that were found with DNA tests that were done in around 2011. I had looked some, I was looking some of this up, looking at a master's thesis that a student had done from Washington State University here in the Tri-Cities. That there were about 10 different, there was DNA tests on about 10 different species that between D and F, 100D, 100F, that resided in these things. So it had to be, that was very challenging for folks for cleanup and stuff. And we're able to leave those in place. I'm sure that they're still there and hopefully healthy. But it's just an example of two things, the types of challenges that we can find in sites like Hanford, both from a cleanup and biological challenges, environmental challenges, but also the importance of making sure that we're good stewards of a landfill like this and that we're managing the waste, because it can be very challenging. So the definition of on-site per 40 CFR 300.400E was designed to create additional space for treatment systems that require considerable area for construction and staging areas. Areas not covered by this definition are said to be off-site. Further, this definition allows for waste from specific site operable units to be moved across an area outside of an OU boundary to other locations technically within a larger site. For example, contaminated debris, soil may be sent from to a waste disposal facility or treatment facility located on another area of the site. This can lead to a lot of confusion, so it's important to clarify when establishing on-site determinations what these challenges are. But again, they're used to determine what waste from specific site operable units can be moved across. And so it can be very challenging. So I've got a little scenario for you to look at. It's a simple kind of a visual of a scenario that where you'd have a lay down where you have a laid equipment lay down area and an operable unit on a larger NPL site. And the question is that would this lay down area be considered on site for the purposes of OU1 from an OU1 response action? So do we have a poll question for that, Gene, or are we just gonna
So we're going to let the audience type that one into the Q&A in case they want to provide some documentation on how they were making their decisions. And so I'm starting to see some answers coming in, but someone did have a question. Is there a scale for the map? So can you provide some sense of scale?
And so while you're thinking about that question and putting in your answers, the scale for this map here, it could be any scale, frankly, right? It you're looking at this yellow area being the NPL site itself, and then an operable unit here, and these are roads, right? So you could look at just a few hundred yards, even in this particular case, the way this one's designed. Does that answer your question? I hope.
I think it does. And so as you put that in perspective for them, I've looked at the responses that are coming in. I would honestly say it's about 50-50. About half of the students are indicating, yes, they think it should be considered on-site. And then some are saying, no, it's not, because it's across the street. Quite frankly, no. Some are saying, well, technically it's on site, but it's not a slam dunk in that classification.
It never is, right? It's never a slam dunk.
Right. So it really does seem like they're 50-50. Half think it could and then half think it couldn't.
And that's appropriate, because it could be either. It depends. It could sometimes be considered on-site for the purposes, or it could be considered off-site. I mean, you look at the examples from the Hanford site, right, where you've got the off-site the on-site ERDF facility and the off-site ETF facility. So, Emmy, do you have any comments on this particular, from a FIFRO standpoint, on this particular scenario?
Well, you know, I was just looking back at the NCP definition where it says that you're looking at suitable areas in very close proximity to the contamination. So is there a definition, X miles or yards, for close proximity that people should be using?
From the NCP definition?
Yeah,
that's a good question. That's tricky, right? Like, what's close? That sounds like the conversations that we have with our other federal and state partners, right? What is close? What does that mean? What is that definition?
The NCP doesn't specifically say if it's within a 1 mile radius, it's close,
right?
Or 500 yards. It close proximity is.
It's close.
Objective to some extent, which is it's so important to talk about that with your site team.
Right, right. And I will tell you that, you know, looking at the Hanford site, that would be a very difficult question to answer, considering 500 square miles of cleanup, right? So, you know, these things can get complicated. And much like the example that we had in Missouri, it is why we have these dispute resolution processes set up, so that we can work through this in an organized and effective way.
We did have one quick clarifying question that just came in. Someone wanted to know, why would a laydown area need a determination of onsite or offsite if no waste was going to be disposed there?
That's a really good question. And thank you for that feedback. I think we could clarify the scenario to say that contaminated equipment or materials could potentially be stored at this laydown area until the remedial action was complete. So in that, and again, trick question that wasn't clearly laid out, so I'll take the hit for that. But we would assume that there would be a potential for the materials being used in the response action and then stored in the laydown area to potentially be moving contamination to that location as well.
Well, and it could, there could be an argument to be made that these questions are a bit ambiguous, because real world challenges can be a bit ambiguous. And so it allows us to ask that question, like, why would we do that? You know, you're sitting down with one of your partners. Why would we have to look at this equipment laydown area and then have to look at some of the data and see what's going on? And so, this could be clearer, I think it does kind of put an exclamation point on the fact that these questions are never as clear as we would like them to be. All right. So in summary, land use determinations are a critical part of a remedy selection under CERCLA. Identifying anticipated future land use. I'm kind of stealing your thunder here, Emmy. I just went right into this. I hope I'm excited, you know. I don't get to do this very often. So, you know, I put on a bow tie for this. I need to get right into it. But if you don't mind, I'll just keep going unless you'd like to. Identify anticipated future land use as early as possible. And she reiterated why that is incredibly important. Consider land use in remedy selection. And then the offsite rule ensures that CERCLA wastes do not contribute to present or future environmental problems. Again, we're trying to clean stuff up. And we're trying to clean it up for the present, and we're trying to clean it up for the future. So it's really important that we do that in a responsible way. And that's where the offsite rule comes in. And CERCLA does not require permits for on-site activities. Again, those are governed by RODs for those activities. And those RODs identify what the site is, and they identify what kind of wastes come in and govern the process. And here in the Hanford site, I mentioned a ROD amendment. We also have ESDs. We have a number of ESDs for the ERDF site in bringing waste in. So it just, again, talks about the fact that these are complicated. These are complicated actions, and they require a lot of thoughtful effort. So sorry to steal your thunder, Emmy.
No worries. That's great. The only thing I wanted to tack on, which we have had a lot of conversations in the Superfund Federal Facilities Program about on-site. You know, when you have a very large federal facility site, many, many acres large, we often would hear an argument from our lead cleanup agency saying, well, the entire site is on-site, so we can put things wherever we want, as long as it doesn't leave the boundaries of the MPL site. We can move this waste over there. We can, you know, it is very important to not assume just because it's within the geographical boundaries of an MPL site that it would automatically be considered on site, particularly when that could be miles away from the location where the response action is taking place. That is a policy discussion that has come up to the headquarters level on several occasions. So again, don't assume on-site means it's a free-for-all for any location of a site when it comes to your response actions.
Very good.
And that's it.
Well, and so I will ask, are there any questions?
Oh, there are questions. So I'm just going to gently remind the audience, if you haven't put your questions into the Q&A, that space is still available. You can keep typing them in. I think we're going to start with some questions that came in earlier, and then we'll work to see if some additional ones have come in. So Emmy, this first question came in early on in the class asking about five-year reviews. It's a pretty straightforward question. It asks, how many five-year reviews are appropriate?
Oh, Emmy, can I get in on a little bit of that?
Oh, sure, go ahead.
So we just finished on the Hanford site our fifth five-year review on the Hanford site. And you having have walked through this process, and you know, there's been a lot of thoughtful conversations about where things are at and where things are going and the possibility of some emerging contaminants and different things that, you know, my answer and Emmy, from a FIFRO standpoint, you can correct me in front of 150 people, but it is as, you know, as long as it's needed. So they go on for a long period of time. And, you know, some of these sites like the Hanford site, we will be doing five-year reviews well after not only I'm retired, or which is a long way from now, but probably long after I've left this planet too. There's things that are going on the Hanford site, half lives of certain constituents and things that'll be, you know, we'll have to be looking at for a long period of time. So how's that answer?
That was a good answer. As long as they're needed, I'll just add on to it. that to say a statutory five-year review is going to be required anytime waste is left in place on the site that precludes unlimited use or unlimited exposure. So if there's any waste or contamination that presents an unacceptable risk after the remedy is implemented, you will be doing five-year reviews to ensure the remedy remains protective in perpetuity, essentially. And I know that's a long time and a little bit hard to process, but as long as that waste and risk is there, the five-year reviews should continue.
Okay. Our next question asks about commercial and industrial use. Are those the same things?
Okay. So, excuse me, I know I was using industrial and commercial a bit interchangeably. When it comes down to it, though, it's very site specific. The commercial uses for your specific site should have specific exposure pathways identified based on the frequency people would be on the site, the duration they would be there per day, per year, and what have you, versus the type of activities that would occur under an industrial scenario, which could potentially be different from, say, an office building type of activity to what would happen in a quarry or something like that. So it really comes down to being site specific, how the inputs for the site use are being considered in your risk assessments.
Okay. We do have another question as well. I'm just going to read this one. It's a comment about residential cleanups. So the participant noted that residential cleanup levels seem based on single family dwellings where occupants have access to dirt and gardens and other soil sources. What about more modern residential use, such as these condominiums or mixed use apartments where the residents would have little or no access directly to the soil? It seems like an industrial cleanup may still be protective of this sort of residential use. And they're just looking for your thoughts on that scenario.
Yeah, that's a very interesting scenario to pose. I would also suggest you look at it from the public's viewpoint. If you told, we want to sell you a condo that's on top of a hazardous waste site, would you like to live here? I think that might not go over very well. However, if you go back and look at what the cleanup levels and the remedial action objectives were in the ROD and see if they would support the building of these condominiums, like how deep into the subsurface would you have to go? If there's a cap in place, would it affect the remedy? If there's a pump and treat infrastructure in place, would it affect the remedy? If the answer is no, the remedy can remain protective, then it might mean that additional response actions aren't necessary, but you would definitely want to work on the communication with the public in moving forward to, I would say, increase the reuse of that location. But it all comes back to, is it protective for this new land use that's being proposed? And looking at the data necessary to answer that question.
Okay. We did have someone comment that other countries actually use two different types for residential. They have low and high density residential areas to sort of acknowledge some of these variations. Okay.
Yeah, a residential scenario at one site could consider a backyard garden, or maybe there's livestock that they take their milk and eggs from. A residential scenario on another site might not go so far as to include those exposure pathways. So it really is specific to what's happening or anticipated for your site.
Sure. Is there a different process? And I bet I know the answer to this one. What if different agencies disagree on reasonable future land use expectations for a site? And if there is a disagreement, is there a process to address this disagreement between the agencies?
So disagreement on reasonable future land use, I think, happens a lot. So you do want to engage in those conversations with your team, the lead cleanup agency, your regulators, in really trying to come to an agreement on what that could look like. For example, at the Hanford site, the Department of Energy has stated, we don't believe anyone will ever live on the site. That's not reasonably anticipated. However, in areas along the cleanup, or of the cleanup that are along, say, the Columbia River, which is a very attractive piece of land, we will do our cleanup to meet a residential scenario to not preclude any potential uses, be it recreational, conservation, what have you. So sometimes you can come to agreement, say, we don't agree on the land use, but we'll agree to a cleanup level that would support what you think is the land use and what we think the land use will be. That's a win-win situation, but it might be you can't come to agreement on that. Like, absolutely, we're not in agreement. In that case, you might have to look at your federal facilities agreement and come to some kind of formal dispute process to get the answer on what makes sense. I think the biggest part is having data to support the argument you're making. If you're saying this area is never going to be developed, but the population has grown by 20% in the last 5 years, encroaching on the site, then it's a little harder to make that argument, right? So it really comes at, I think if you look at it realistically with the information available, you can try and come to some kind of agreement. And Jeff, did you want to answer? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just was going to, we also at the Hanford site, it's an incredibly important part of where we're at geographically, or some of our stakeholders, our tribal stakeholders and our obligations to treaties and whatnot. Can you talk about that a little bit and that, how that feeds into the end use process?
Well, again, I think that just comes back to having those conversations early and frequently and throughout your cleanup process, not only on what the anticipated land use is, but what the needs of these different stakeholder groups are. I know when it comes to treaty rights and federal facilities, that can be a very long conversation or difficult to have. But the point is that we have the conversation and right. work through it to get to a point where we can move forward with the cleanup.
Right.
Okay. We did have a question about BRAC cleanups that came in earlier, very early in the session. And they were just wondering who would oversee DOD in a BRAC cleanup scenario? Is it EPA, another entity?
So since 2016, EPA has not been conducting oversight of those BRAC cleanups, but I believe it is the states that provide oversight for cleanup in their areas.
Okay. We did have a question too about vapor intrusion. Okay. And just how you might handle a land use determination when you have vapor intrusion concerns for a site. So let's say you have a site that has buildings, and they were just wondering what land use determination would be made that would essentially disqualify those buildings from being evaluated in capacity for like sub slab or indoor air concentrations relative to risk. So they're talking about a building that's being used for storage that does not have regular indoor occupants. And so therefore wouldn't be the same thing as a residential or a commercial facility with employees in the building.
Right. So in those cases, or like if it was an office building or a residence, then you would have probably likely response actions to address the risk proposed there. But if it is, say, a building used primarily for storage, and if there were restrictions in accessing that building, you know, institutional controls that stated you will vent the building through its windows and doorways for 30 minutes before entering or something like that, then you might be able to incorporate that if it's being used for a more of an industrial type scenario or strictly for storage in a non-residential scenario. But that gets a little tricky with the site specifics. I don't know what the remedial the REOs are for the site or what the anticipated land use is. So I think it would depend on a lot of those site specifics. But it could be possible that ICs could allow those buildings to serve a purpose as the cleanup moves forward.
Okay. Okay, well, a lot of the questions that I see in the queue actually get into the classes that you'll be delivering and the whole Federal Facilities Academy and orders of classes. Is it okay if I jump to those right now?
Sure.
Okay, so one of the first questions is ordering, and I think you hit on this earlier, but just in case we had people joining us a little bit late, people understand that there are online webinars, there are 11 of them, and then there is a singular 3-day in-person class. They want to know, can you do the 3-person class before you complete the webinars, or do you have to do the webinars in some form, either live or replay, before you take that in-person class?
No, you don't have to have completed the webinars before taking the in-person class. I, again, just want to clarify that the Federal Facility Remedial Project Manager course, the in-person course, does assume you have a basic understanding of CERCLA. So if you're new to CERCLA, I would take some other trainings to catch up on what CERCLA is and how it works, and then take this Federal Facility RPM course.
All right. And then a follow-on question. They want to know if they can mix and match across the years. So let's say they take the webinars in 22 this year, but they are unable to get to a classroom delivery until 2023 or later. Can they still get an Academy certificate if they, you know, complete these courses over different calendar years?
Absolutely. There's no restriction on the calendar years, particularly with the last couple of years we've had. So as long as you have completed the 11 webinars and that in-person course, you can get your certificate of completion.
Okay. And then lots of people were wondering how far out you've scheduled the classroom deliveries. So if they cannot attend the one that's been scheduled for this year, do you have any plans for future dates or additional dates this calendar year or perhaps in the following year? Any information on additional sessions?
I believe we have the next in-person session set up for June in Denver, late June. And we may have another course in the fall. But our goal is to offer this training a couple of times a year, again, starting in June. So this year, next year, it should continue to be offered.
Okay. Well, Emmy, I think those are all of the technical questions and the class-related ones for today. Were there any final thoughts you wanted to leave the audience with before I go through our final reminders?
Sure. Just if you have any questions or follow-up information on this webinar, please feel free to contact me. That is my contact information on the screen. And I know Jean's going to plug the evaluation feedback forms. Definitely, if you think there's a way we can improve this training or other examples we could use that would be helpful, please let us know. We try to improve these every time we offer them, and we would love your feedback. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you very much, everybody.
All right. Thank you so very much. So at this time, I'm going to go ahead and walk through just a few final reminders here before we close out our session today. And let me go ahead and turn on my screen share. So hopefully everyone can see the slides on my end now. And I'll go ahead and just remind everyone, if you joined us a bit late, remember this is part of that ongoing Federal Facilities Online Academy series. So we have just completed class number 4 in this session, and we will carry on with our 5th webinar in the series in June. So we hope that you can join us. Remember, you can participate in any or all of these live or replay any of the recorded sessions. Now, as Emmy highlighted, you can absolutely share your feedback with us. I'm going to show you how to fill out that feedback form in just a moment. But I did want to remind everyone that we encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network at cluin.org. You'll see that we're going through a bit of a website refresh and redesign. So I'll encourage you to look for icons like the following. You should see those in the upper corners of the page where you can access our podcasts, our RSS feeds, or subscribe to our email newsletters. One of our most popular resources on Cluin is our monthly newsletter Tech Direct that goes out on the first of each month and will highlight free online technical training like today's session. So I encourage you to become a subscriber to Tech Direct if you're not already on there so that you can get alerted when webinars like today is available for registration. As we talked about earlier, there is a unique seminar homepage. It's a website that is active from today forward. The URL is shown here in red. And on that seminar homepage, you'll see a series, if you scroll up and down, of sections that will contain information, including links to download the presentation materials, which come in the format of a student manual, includes both the slides and then supplemental notes. So the student manual includes the slides. You can download those. There's information about your presenters and then our feedback form to let us know what you thought of the delivery. So you can visit that seminar homepage and click on the form and fill it out. I can provide you with the participation certificate after you complete that feedback form. Please make sure you fill out your name and email address correctly and certify that you attended the entire live event or replayed the entire recording. So there's a box at the bottom of the form that you need to check. And then as soon as you submit your feedback, you'll have access to either download the certificate, and we will also email a copy of it to you. Oftentimes those emails can get blocked as spam. So I always find it helpful to download the certificate right from that confirmation page and save it for your own record. If you happen to have multiple people participate in your location, each person can fill out that feedback form, even if they didn't register on their own, and they can still get their own participation certificate. So I ask those of you who did register to be sure to get the link to the homepage to your colleagues who joined you in person so they can share their thoughts and get their own certificate. And if you happen to be one of the lucky people replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still follow those URL prompts and head on over to the seminar homepage to fill it out and provide feedback to get your own certificate. So right about now in the upper right corner of the online archive, you should see a feedback form button appear, and that should take you right on over to the feedback form to complete based off of your replay. Once that archived version is available, we'll send an email to everyone who registered so that you can access it and share it with your colleagues. And so with that, I want to thank everybody who joined us for today's live session, along with our presenters who took time to share their expertise. We'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live session. Thank you so very much for joining us today.